Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse, great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices, changing the mood of food.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, and our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson is back from his fact-finding mission to the States and will be joining us throughout the show. But first up, as reported by Vince Rigari in the Nine newspapers last week, the Australian Professional League's chairman, Stephen Conroy, has admitted the A-League's had no choice but to abandon its overly ambitious strategy and slash costs to stay afloat in a decision that has left clubs scrambling to address a dramatic financial shortfall and the professional game facing a period of austerity. The net effect, club distributions for the 24-25 season have been reduced to just $530,000, which means club owners will have to find an extra $2.2 million just to cover the salary cap in the men's and women's leagues. It's a cut of almost $1.5 million from last season and $3 million from the high of about 6 years ago when the competitions were administrated by Football Australia and broadcast on Fox Sports. What does this all mean to the viability of the competition? We'll discuss it all with the ABC's Daniel Garb. Then the Euros are at the real pointy end with just four of the traditional European nations surviving the first semi-final between Spain and France. But the England-Netherlands tie is the one we are salivating over. Well, anyone knows who follows football knows and is well aware the only major title won by the Three Lions was the 1966 World Cup. The Dutch drought since their only major title now extends to 36 years since their current manager, Ronald Koeman, was a vital member of the side which won the 1988 Euros. We'll discuss it all with former England and Liverpool man and now one of the world's leading football pundits, the BBC's Stephen Warnock. And Edge, we haven't even mentioned the Copa America. Uruguay beat Brazil.
Flying. Uruguay absolutely flying. The magic of Bielsa continues.
And the big question, I guess, I don't want to knock over Willem's pins here, but no extra time. The Uruguayans were down to 10 men, go straight into penalties and win. But we'll discuss all that later. Before we go to Willem, Derek, welcome back.
Thank you, gents. So I tell you what, I like that. No extra time, go straight to penalties. I think that should be adopted everywhere.
But the fact that the Uruguayans knew that they could commit a foul late in the match when they were on the verge of conceding suggests that, you know, penalties equalises it straight away, so there's no advantage to the team that has the extra man. Another conversation for another day. Willem, what are your thoughts on the subject?
My thoughts on the penalty subject, I really like it, although as you just alluded to there, every decision you make is going to, as time rolls on, produce these little sort of niche changes. And I've just thought of VAR, introduce one thing, change another. And you've been pretty upset about the VAR this week, Rob, in the group chat, regarding Spain and Mark Cucurella. The boil down effect of all of that was that Mikel Merino's extra time header has seen Spain defeat Germany and move into the semis for the fourth time in the past 5 Euros.
Dani Olmo, Mikel Merino! In the 120th minute, Mikel Merino surely puts Spain into the semi-final.
And in that semi-final, they are going to meet France, who despite scoring just thrice in 5 games, one of those from the penalty spot and the other 2 own goals, they have progressed past Portugal from the penalty spot. The other semi-final, as you alluded to, Rob, will see England and the Netherlands meet at a major tournament for the first time since 1996. But the real history, as you were right to point out earlier in the week, is that it is in World Cup qualifying of 1993 that this rivalry really did come to the boil. Ronald Koeman getting away with the last man dragged down and then scoring at the other end to end England's chances of going to the USA. Derek, the famous line from then England manager Graham Taylor was that the referee's got me the sack. Thank him ever so much for that, won't you?
Yeah, I just about have the memory of those tussles. I remember a young Dennis Bergkamp emerging around in Euro 92. When England were flailing around in qualification then as well. I wonder, though, whether England have got a secret agent, though, because it's taken me a little while to realise that Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank is on the sidelines for England. He's an assistant coach to Gareth Southgate. He was a formidable player in his time, I mean, despite being a, a Chelsea player. I loved watching him. He was always bristling with aggression. Loved a shot. Could hit the ball at 100 miles an hour. And I think he's a, you know, must be a really great presence. A lot of the team, Jude Bellingham and others, have really complimented their vibes. They all go on about vibes, don't they, that he brings to this team. So maybe he'll know a thing or two about the Dutch psyche, Willem, and maybe England will have a different plan, because the current plan is coming under a lot of criticism.
What did you make of the penalty shootout, Derek? Five England players all slotting them, all stepped up and took them really nicely. And you think back to the Euro 2020 final played in 2021, Bukayo Saka and Jadon Sancho missing. Sancho not there this time, but Saka stood up and, having scored the goal, your man from Arsenal, stood up a second time and slotted it, one of five, to be feeling pretty good about themselves. And Jordan Pickford as well.
Yeah, well, Pickford was playing the mind games and got that save with a Kanji early on, which really set England on their way. But these were five ice-cold penalties. I don't think any of them looked like missing. That, you know, Saka, there's obviously that heart-in-the-mouth moment, because you don't want him to go through what he went through two or three years ago with the missed penalty against Italy. But none of them looked like missing. And probably the one who was closest was Ivan Toney, with his one- or two-step run-up, not looking at the ball. And the goalkeeper nearly got fingertips to it. But, you know, Toney doesn't miss penalties. And if he's been brought along to do just that job, then I think he's the perfect weapon for England. I was listening to Talk About Radio, which I often do, to gauge the pulse of the nation. And they're just very much in two camps at the moment. There are some that are just, doesn't matter how we win, as long as we win and we're through. And the others are still people absolutely scathing about the overall quality of the performances and the fact that they kind of mismatch against what on paper is a really fine looking side. I did pick out one for everyone to listen to from Talk About Radio, and hopefully Adam can cue that up for us now.
Today was about the entire team, not just Gareth Southgate. And if you said that, I would applaud you happily. But Mr. Southgate is a bit boring. Come on, we are in the semis now. We need to invigorate, and we've got to see some fire. You know, we are the lions and king of the jungle. We're not dolphins. We're not smiling and saying, oh, hi guys, we're here to entertain you. But if
dolphins can't talk,
it's okay. Sorry?
Dolphins can't talk.
Oh, they can't. They can sign and mimic and smile. And they're smart. I made the wrong example. I apologise to the Dolphins. I think I gave too much compliment to Gareth Southgate.
Leaving aside that Lions live on the savannah, not in the jungle, Edge, the key question here is, should England be Lions or Dolphins?
Well, they should be Lions, shouldn't they? But at the end of the day, I think what we're seeing in all these major tournaments is that defences win them. And I think if you look at all the statistics over the journey, defences are the key to lifting trophies, and that's where Southgate's been his entire career as coach of England.
Plenty more Euros and England with Stephen Warnock later on. For now, though, the Copper, Argentina, Uruguay and Canada have all reached the semi-finals on penalties, while Colombia make up the final four after a 5-0 win over Panama. Lionel Messi missed his quarter-final penalty for Argentina, although Emi Martinez spared him with two saves and was carrying on with the fans as usual. They're going to meet Canada in the semi-finals, who have progressed despite conceding perhaps the goal of the tournament to Venezuela's Salomon Rondon, a name of years gone by in the Premier League.
Long one into the box. Aramaru blasted out to midfield. Now Rondon racing for it. Trying to catch the keeper out of the box. And he scores from out near midfield. The all-time leading goal scorer for Venezuela has leveled this game with Canada here in the quarterfinal round.
Uruguay also defeating Brazil on penalties after a nil-all draw, while James Rodriguez, a decade after announcing himself to the world at the Brazil World Cup, scored and set up two more for Colombia in their rout of Panama. Ed, your top line on the Copper?
Well, fantastic performance by Canada to reach the semi-finals. That's looking really fabulous for 2026, that group of players that were successfully made the World Cup in 2022 in Qatar, continuing their form. It's great news. And Colombia, I've got to like them. They are scoring goals for fun right through the tournament, and maybe Colombia might go all the way.
and the Canadian coach, Rob, Jesse Marsh, a mate of our mate, Mark Jackson, enjoying the upswing of coaching after a pretty brutal time at Leeds. He's loving life at the minute.
Well, interesting, isn't it? Two former Leeds managers doing well there. And, you know, probably some of the Lily Whites regretting that they let Marcelo Bielsa go as well as Jesse Marsh. So, you know, excited to see him, re-stamp his credentials. I don't think, showed the best of himself as a manager in the Premier League. And, you know, it's easy to knock the North American managers for their lack of success and their, you know, their early exits from, you know, the top flight when they've had those chances. But you mentioned the Messi miss. I'm not sure whether we all watched it. I was certainly watching it at the time, but it was a Panenka that hit the bar, so it wasn't saved. And it just shows that the talent and skill of a player, even like him, can't execute it. And just coincidentally, there had been an article on Antonin Panenka, who's still with us, who famously executed that Panenka in the 1976 Euro final for Czechoslovakia, the then Czechoslovakia over West Germany. So that's just a little side note to consider.
Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army. Head to ggrtravel.com and lock yourself onto that mailing list for the 2026 Men's World Cup in the States, Canada and Mexico, Edge.
Yes, and you can also register interest for going to see the Socceroos play in Japan this coming October. That product launches very soon. And also we'll be heading to China in March and even Saudi Arabia in the heat of June next 2025.
You've always told me Saitama is one hell of a place. Is that where they're playing that one? Just quickly.
Yes, it is. It's Saitama. We'll be staying in Shinjuku, and all of us will be catching the tube, all of the 19 stops out to Saitama.
Our skipper needs a new club, though, Edge. He being Matt Ryan, he's finishing up with AZ Alkmaar, where he's more than solid across his 18 months. Again, just can't really make a move stick long-term, but at 32, still plenty of good years left. Another start for Mitch Duke in the J-League as Mashita Zelvia roll on, a 1-0 win over Nagoya Grampus, who, as always, had Mitch Langerak in goal, so Mashita Zelvia still 5 points clear. But things not getting better for Harry Kuehl at Yokohama, Edge. 4-0, they were belted by Gamba Osaka, and they are still down in 13th.
Rob Gilbert, your prediction that Harry might coach the Socceroos at some point in the near future is looking a bit shaky.
No, I said when he was in about his 60s, so he's got a few sackings to go before that happens. He's got a lot to learn. But no, in all seriousness, it's a bit sad, really, that if Harry does go out from that job after, you know, the great success of Kevin Muscat and Ange Postecoglou, that it might be a while before he gets another top flight gig.
Small wins for Nestori Irinkunda. He's on the score sheet for Bayern Munich for the first time. This is Bayern Munich 2 in a 2-1 preseason loss to Austria Lichtenau. And in case you missed it, a couple of Matildas also on the lookout for new clubs. Mackenzie Arnold leaving West Ham after 4 seasons, a decision which she described as one of the hardest she's had to make. And Hayley Rasso also has departed Real Madrid after 12 months in Spain. So the Matildas are officially in camp ahead of the Paris Games. All members of the squad are there now for an extended training camp, and they've also locked in a final hit out against Canada later in the week, Rob.
Okay, well done, Willem. Daniel Garb sitting in the green room right now, waiting to come on and talk about the announcement from the head office, Stephen Conroy. We don't see a lot of Stephen Conroy, but geez, he's dropped a bucket of stinking turd on the game with the announcement that they're slashing their club distributions. Obviously, football will continue and survive, but it's at its nadir right now in terms of funding. It'll be fascinating. I saw Daniel's tweet during the week. He does have some positive thoughts on how it might all end up, but it's going to be a tricky time before that all happens. So stick around after the break. Daniel Garb will talk us through it on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
If following the A-League wasn't challenging enough, APL independent chair Stephen Conroy this week warned fans to hold on tight through an upcoming period of turbulence that may last until the new TV deal of 2026-27. With the APL's distribution to clubs now at 530,000 Australian a season, where it once sat at around 3.5 million under Football Australia, it really does make you wonder just how low we can go. Daniel Garb has followed the A-League both as a fan and professionally since the very start, and it feels like we need his counsel right now. Garby, g'day and welcome back.
Thanks, boys. Good to be with you, Willem and Edge. It's testing times for all of us.
Most certainly is. We had a silence from Stephen Conroy and Nick Garcia for a long time this season. People were just desperate for a little bit of information here, there, and wherever it might come. And now that we've got it, it's fair to say that it's been a pretty brutal week.
I think they knew what they were stepping into, to be honest. That was pretty clear. And I don't think anyone's saying that they've made the wrong decision in terms of these cuts. They're obviously necessary decisions. They also were made pretty clear when all the redundancies at the APL were handed down as well, which was very sad. So this has been coming. Unfortunately, it just raises the question of the whole dependence move. Has that been just a complete disaster for the game? Can it be rectified from here? Will this be handed back the A-Leagues to Football Australia? Did we have to go down this path? The people who made this decision told us that we did, told us it's the only way the A-League is going to grow is if they go independent of Football Australia. And in theory, there were plenty of positives there. But so far, we yet to see any. In fact, we only see negatives. That's not a crack at anyone who made the decisions. I'm sure they did it in very good faith. But that is simply the facts. I mean, this is a perilous situation to have club distributions the level of $530,000, to have had $25 million spent on a digital plan that went up in smoke in the space of a couple of years, to have had all these redundancies made, to have had the grand final decision, selling it to Sydney and then reversing it, and all the backlash that came from that. It just has not worked out at all, and it's sent the league backwards. It has. And that doesn't mean that it can't be rectified, and I'm sure we'll speak about that. But right now, it's just a really sad situation. And it harps back to that day in August 2018, I was in the room when Stephen Lowy said, be careful what you wish for. This is not about the Lowys. This is about Football Australia's position at the time. Be careful what you wish for. And unfortunately, that quote is just ringing in our ears right now.
$140 million from Silver Lake. It was, pretty exciting when that money came into the game, and Stephen Conroy this week has all but confirmed that that has been largely frittered away. Do you think that, and the APL board has changed largely from that initial group that took over in sort of over New Year 2020, 2021, but, and Conroy has this week indicated that the high spend digital strategy and the rest and the penalties from the broadcast deal have sort of been the main sort of factors behind that. But do you think we've had enough clarity as fans, as members, as Paramount Plus subscribers as to where that cash has gone?
Maybe not. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. There's the digital keep up strategy that just hasn't worked. The TV deal, that's part of it, and then club losses, and also keeping Perth afloat, keeping the Newcastle Jets afloat. They've been big, unfortunately, our revenue drainers. So do we need any more detail than that? I don't think so. Do we need them perhaps to come forward and be in front of the camera and explain it a bit better at certain times? Yeah, I think there's a fair argument for that they could be a little bit more assertive in the manner in which they explain these things, as opposed to journos having to dig and call and request and get nothing back. That's fair. I think in terms of the outlining of where it's all gone, I think we've got a reasonable understanding. I'm sure there's some other avenues down there that, perhaps the money's been spent on that we aren't quite clear on. And yeah, I mean, it'd be nice to know everything, but you could say that about every organisation that exists. You're not going to find out where every single dollar's gone, unfortunately. But yes, I think we understand the general sense of it all. I don't know if I want to know any more, boys. It's depressing, and it is.
Certainly is depressing, isn't it, Garby? But that day that you referenced there in 2018, when Stephen Lowy made the comments about be careful what you wish for, that was the culmination of what was a civil war in the sport, the clubs versus the federation leadership, and in particular the Lowy regime at the time. There was a lot of carnage left from that. Obviously, the Lowy era at Football Australia came to an end, Gallup's era came to an end. And now we're at a situation where there's a lot of people in the football community talking about the potential for the APL actually going under and handing the keys back to Football Australia. Do you think there's any truth to that discussion around the football community? Do you think that's a possibility at some point in the future?
Undeniably a possibility. I mean, it just has to be. I mean, I can't see how the clubs can survive with a distribution less than what they're getting at the moment. $530,000 is bargain basement. So, of course, it's a possibility. They've gone back to ground zero, the APL, and they had to, and that's okay. I don't think anyone is necessarily criticising the decisions that have been made in the last few months. If that's what the landscape determines they have to do, then fine. And if they don't get it right from here, if they don't build slowly and build in the correct manner, knowing that they have little margin for error, then if it gets worse, I don't see how there isn't a likely scenario where it's given back to Football Australia. And that would be just such a shame for everyone if it happens, because, you know, it was avoidable. And Football Australia is, I think, flourishing at the moment, looking after the Matildas and the Socceroos and our national youth teams without having to work on the A-League, which is just, you know, very, as you can imagine, detailed process and requires a lot of staff and a lot of concentration. And, you know, our national teams have done really well with this independence. I think Football Australia has actually come out of the breakaway better than anyone else. But they've got to get it right now. If they don't do this well over the next couple of years and build back slowly and start to stabilise and build the fan bases and build the revenue bases of the club and get a TV deal going in the right direction, because that's probably going to go down the next time they negotiate as well. And I imagine these distributions are to go with the budgeting for that. If they don't start building that up again, then, yeah, I think it's an extremely likely scenario that the A-League falls under Football Australia's jurisdiction once more.
I guess we have to cut Stephen Conroy a little bit of slack. I mean, he's only a recent addition. I mean, a lot of people were very critical that the APL didn't have an independent chairperson from the get-go. They had Paul Lederer as a chairperson, but we never heard from him. He never articulated any public sort of vision or strategy. That was left to Danny Townsend. But the clock's ticking on Conroy now. Do you think Conroy has got it in him to steer the ship through these troubled waters?
Who knows? I mean, it's impossible to answer that. Both he, Nick Garcia and Stephen Conroy present really well. Conroy's very experienced at dealing with, you know, this level of public organisation. Nick Garcia's an experienced guy and seems to be a pretty shrewd guy, but whether they're the people to guide us through this, we just don't know. It's too hard and there are too many variables at play. What I do know is they've got to go about this slowly and surely. I think they realise that. And it's got to be a back-to-basics program from the bottom up that just concentrates on looking after the football fans and the football community and the clubs and growing from there. And I think where we landed up in trouble is the desire for grand plans, the desire to... And everyone still wants that at the end. Everyone still wants football in Australia to be as big as it can possibly be and the A-League to be glitzy and glamorous and have as much largesse as possible. But doing that sometime before we had the base solidified enough has got us into some trouble. And I think we just need to go back to growing the base like many a code has done before, like the NBL had to do recently, like rugby union having to do now, like other codes have had to do in the past. Even the AFL and NRL have had to reconfigure things over time. It's a recalibration at the moment. And it's simply about looking after the football fan. If they concentrate on that, stick to that, are patient with that, and have great communication, crucially, with the supporters and the clubs and the stakeholders in the media on that, then it can be done. It can, but it's also a very difficult task.
Gabby, and this is what it means in reality. About 2 weeks ago, Richard Peel, the chairman of and owner of Central Coast Mariners, wrote to his members and said that despite the transfer income and the Asian Cup prize money, the AFC Asian Cup, that is, prize money, the club still lost $1.8 million in its triple trophy winning season last season. So obviously in that letter to his members, he talks about the blow that is the reductions in distributions for next year. and that the club will be forced to find that money. I mean, that's the reality, isn't it? I mean, Mariners won't be on their own there in terms of clubs running at a loss and reliant on the benefactors of their owners to keep tipping in. It's a bitter pill to swallow for a club like the Mariners that's given us so much over the last 3 years.
It really is. You feel for someone like Richard, he should be, you know, over the moon. But and I'm sure he is with what the club's doing on the field, and that's given him great joy. But there's still a big financial hole, and it will be the same for all the other clubs. Speak to someone like Tony Sage, and he loved Perth Glory, loved being a part of it. And he lost a fortune of money on it. It is very difficult being a club owner of any sport, any club in any sport. The majority lose money. But that has been the case in a large way in Australian football. They've always been told, though, that the value of the club will rise. Yes, the profit season on season, you know, it may be hard to generate that, but the value of the club will rise. Investment will grow because the league overall will continue to grow. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened now. And so now their actual asset as an owner has decreased because the TV rights deal is smaller, because the standard of player they attract is now lower. I guess that perhaps the silver lining in the cloud is that more young players are going to get a go because of the reduction in distribution, and that can potentially mean that you're able to sell players, more players, for profits overseas. That might work. That was trending that way anyway, wasn't it, in recent times in Australian football? But they might look at that as, all right, that's our avenue to making some money here in the next few years. But then you can say, well, the loss in of finances also affects the ability to invest in the academy and our ability to produce more talent coming through. So you can look at it both ways. But yeah, you feel for the owners enormously who have put so much money and so much blood, sweat and tears into their football clubs, and they're managing.
Yep, any awkwardness around, or you know, conscious ignorance, as some fans like to sort of play out around the term of development league, is going to be pretty firmly challenged over the next couple of years. You would think, Garby, we can hear the exasperation and sort of the exhaustion in your voice. But as I said, you've been a fan and a broadcaster and a journalist around this league since the very start, and you're in the trenches for a reason. So always awesome to chat at times like this, mate. All the best, and we'll catch you down the track.
Thanks, boys. Australian football's been through a lot. It's kind of what we know. Challenges like this, correct. So. I'd back us to come out of it the other side.
Daniel Garb there. Stick around on the other side of the break. Rob and Derek are back with Stephen Warnock. The Euros getting to the pointy end.
Hey, guys. It's time to stock up and save right now at Chemist Warehouse. Now, Derek, little children, thank you, Edge. In your home, Panadol Children's. That's got to be in the medicine cabinet, doesn't it?
Every night, my wife has it like an ammo belt across a midriff. And she's got them ready to go at any time.
Exactly, mate. So that'd be the Panadol Children 5 to 12 years, orange or strawberry, 200 mils for just $19.99. And the Betadine Sore Throat Gargle. Willem, you've braved some pretty cold weather in your time over there in Europe. You're enjoying the warmth right now. But the old sore throat, when it starts to tickle, is not comfortable, is it?
Especially when you're preparing for Box to Box, Rob, and you've done all your prep, you've watched football all week, you're excited to get on and chat some round ball with the boys, and then you've got that little tickle, and that's when the throat gargle comes in very handy.
That's what you do, the Betadine Sore Throat Gargle. Get it from Chemist Warehouse, 120 mils for $10.99. Now, while you're at Chemist Warehouse, save on all the vitamins and supplements you need. So, Edge, a bit of muscle... help assistance is needed with the magnesium, the Austolin calcium vitamin D3 plus magnesium, 200 tablets for just $30.99. The creaking body from all those days at Heidelberg.
Absolutely. I do in Bangkok don't have a car, so I leg it everywhere and the big fella gets around. I do get the old creaky muscles. The magnesium helps with that, Rob.
It sure does, and that's 45% off the recommended retail price. Now get your Barocca Energy or Immune, 60 tablets for just $19.99 each. I know I've got a 23-year-old in this house that needs a Barocca from time to time for various reasons. I'll leave that you to work out. Chemist Warehouse, the great savings there every single day.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
for Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices, changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yeah, we talked about the Copa America off the top, as well as the Euros, both at the very pointy end. And in Europe, four of the traditional European nations survived. By the time many of our listeners tune in, they'll know the Spain-France result, but they certainly won't know the England-Dutch tie, which is a little more than 48 hours away. And we're really excited that we've got one of the world's top football pundits from the BBC, the former England and Liverpool man himself, Stephen Warnock. How are you, Stephen?
I'm very good, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, really good, mate. And look, I guess, you know, England is the hot topic. Willem, who's on our show as well, has got the Dutch background. So, you know, he's hoping for a different result. But look, anyone who knows football knows that England's got the talent to go all the way. That's not a question. But it's the question that's been on everybody's lips from day one, how the talent's deployed, that is the constant complaint of the pundits and the fans. We all know that the lightning rod is Gareth Southgate. Gary Lineker described the team's performance as shit after the Denmark 1-1 draw. Some of the fans booed and threw cups at him after the Slovenia result. So two come-from-behind knockout wins, Stephen. Are we talking about some severe mental strength from Southgate to, you know, to just hold his nerve till the very end? I mean, are you prepared to say now that he's sort of crossed that Rubicon with his fiercest critics, or is that only going to happen if they lift the trophy?
I think it'll only happen if they win the trophy. I think when you look at the squad that they've got, the talent that they've got is incredible. My biggest thing with this, with the manager and the squad, is that you've arguably got the most attack-minded squad we've ever had, littered with talent all over the pitch, but you've got a defence-minded manager. You've got a manager who wants to protect the back line. I've been interested listening to Phil Foden talk about how they press in training, but they don't seem to do it in games. And I often look at that and think, well, if you had, for talking sake, Klopp and Guardiola, and we go to them too because of the best that we've seen in a long time and in the way that they look at the game. Do you think they'd accept that on a pitch if they weren't pressing? They drag players off. They make changes straight away. And I just don't know whether, even looking back at the game the other day, it was a reaction to going behind against the Swiss that he makes changes. The changes aren't there beforehand. And I just wonder whether Gareth's got that tactical understanding, that ability to change a game, to look at it 10 minutes before it unfolds, which I think the best managers have that ability to do, to see gaps in opponents and capitalise on them by making quicker changes. And that's been my gripe with Gareth all along. I've always said Gareth Southgate's a great front of house. I think he's incredible with the press. I think what he's done for the team in connecting the audience and the fan base is being nothing short of brilliant. But it doesn't count for anything if you don't get results on the pitch. Now, he's had a great run. I think he's been fortunate in the draws that he's had in previous competitions. But this time, when you look at the way that the draw is going, if England don't get to the final and win it, I think there'll be major questions asked.
And he's up against Ronald Koeman, who, you know, you only have to go back to the last time England missed a World Cup, 1993, that infamous incident where he got that cynical yellow card, kept England out of the World Cup. We know that Koeman has got the ruthless streak in him. The Dutch, you know, they've won one major trophy themselves, 1988 Euros with that star-studded lineup. But Southgate, again, another knock, is 5 wins in 25 matches against top 10 ranked opponents. So, I mean, you can somehow find your way through by, you know, as much as good luck than management when you're up against some of the lesser sides without that elite strike force. But the Dutch are another thing altogether.
To a certain degree, they are. They're littered with quality, but I think they lack in forward areas. I think if you look at Depay's a great player individually and can take people on quite comfortably. But in front of goal, he's not clinical. I think Gakpo off the left-hand side is obviously the star performer from them. Simons is still young, still a little bit inexperienced. His decision making will get better as he matures, but I don't think he's quite at that next stage of being a world class player yet. And off the right, Malins, I mean, you look at him, he's a little bit inconsistent, but he'll cause problem. I like the Dutch squad. I think they're a very organised team in the way that they play. They're very similar to England. I think the Dutch fans probably feel the same, is that they want more out of the team. They want them to be a little bit more open, a little bit more expansive, a little bit more attacking. But I think both managers understand now that the gulf in quality has changed at international level. It's shortened. It's got better. Players have improved massively from the smaller nations, and they have to take them more seriously. But when you're going head-to-head against, England and Holland, it's always going to be a tactical battle. It's always going to be a game of maybe an individual stepping up and taking the game by that one magic moment where he dances around the player, makes something happen, and that could be the outcome of the game. But I do feel that this is a very evenly matched game. I think both teams will be very wary of each other. I think you have to put more pressure on the Dutch backline than we've been doing in recent weeks. I think if Van Dijk is watching Harry Kane go deep, I think he'll be absolutely delighted. I think he'll be just thinking, this is an easy game for me. You've got to test Van Dijk. You've got to push him back towards his own penalty area. He's not the Van Dijk that was there 4 or 5 years ago. I think there's a little bit of a lack of protection within the Dutch team to him in front of him. I don't think he gets as well screened. So that leaves them a little bit more vulnerable at the back. And there's plenty of opportunities to hurt the Dutch team. But likewise, there's a lot of ways to hurt the England team.
The recent game, Stephen, the analysis has really been in two parts. So there was the game itself, and then there was the penalty shootout. If we start with the shootout, we obviously saw five immaculate penalties, possibly the five best penalties that any England side has ever put together in a row. Could you talk about how the art of penalty taking has changed, you know, in the last 20 years from your personal, your time in the game? What was your technique, Stephen? And would you feel like trying an Ivan Toney special?
I'd never try that. I mean, that is just incredible skill. I mean, what tells you more than anything that it's an incredible skill is there's not many players who can do it. And he's one of the ones who's been able to master it. I think from my point of view, I was talking to someone about this at the weekend and saying, I used to take penalties as a youngster and was quite prolific, and I missed one. And the psyche of it got to me, and I started to doubt myself every time I took a penalty then. I think what we miss now is, or what we don't realise as much is the psychology side of the game. Having an in-house psychologist working with teams, and every Premier League team will have one, most European top teams will have a psychologist working with them. And it's about the mental state you get yourself into going up to that to take that penalty. I think that's the belief in what you do, the repetition of taking penalties and training as much as you can. And I know people say you can't replicate that, but what you can replicate is you can replicate technique and trying that technique time and time again. If you go back to the famous saying of Tiger Woods, I think it was when he hit a one iron in or a two iron in, and everyone said, how did you hit that shot? I mean, it's one of the most incredible shots you've ever hit. And he said, I've hit that shot 1,000 times in practice. And that's the mindset that you take yourself into. It's just that is what I do, and that's how I take it. And I think, listen, it's a lot of pressure on the players, but the pressure that those players play and week in, week out within in the top teams in the Premier League and around the world is that pressure to them is normal. And I think that's a big difference. The more and more you can put yourself in those pressure situations, the better you become. And I think that's what the players have become accustomed to now.
Yeah, the narrative is all the way through the shootout. Of course, Bukayo Saka, everyone was delighted and I think a little relieved when his penalty was tucked into the corner. But closer to home for you with Trent, obviously another lightning rod in this tournament has been his role in this England team. He was brought on as a substitute, and Gareth Southgate said after the game that, you know, Trent is one of the, you know, finest penalty takers in the side. There was no doubt in his mind. I mean, he was never going to miss that penalty the way he hit the ball and concentrated, got the elevation. Don't think two goalkeepers would have got there. Now, what does that say about his mental resilience? And does it sort of indicate that there is still a role for him to play in these remaining games in the tournament?
Yeah, what I also thought was interesting was it was also picked up on the analysis by the I think it was the BBC when I was listening to it, was when you think back to the Euros final, the players who came on didn't have much time to get into the game, didn't get any touches on the ball, weren't really warm coming into it. He brought these players on a little bit earlier, knowing that it might go to penalties, and he wanted to get them on the pitch, get them warm. So hats off to Gareth, because that's something that he's learned and he's put into the game. But with Trent, I think just that belief in himself, where wherever he stands over a free kick, when we watch him for Liverpool or England, he just knows he's got that quality to deliver. And again, I go back to that position of putting yourself in that situation time and time again. And people just think, oh, it's a natural ability. It's a natural gift that he's got. Yeah, he has, but he also has to master it as well. He also has to work hard and practice at it. I worked with one of the best set piece takers in world football, David Beckham, when I was at England. He didn't just walk off a training pitch. He stood there for hours practicing afterwards. And I think this is one of the things that people don't often take into consideration is that the work that goes in behind the scenes. People just think that these guys are gifted and that they'll just walk up and put it in the corners. It's not that at all. They've probably missed 20, 30 penalties in practice trying to make sure that the technique is just as accurate as they can make it. It's also believing in where you're going to put that penalty and sticking to it and having that mindset as well, not to change your mind. If the keeper guesses the right way, the power's going to be there and it's going to have the accuracy as well. So from Trent's point of view, I think it's probably not being the ideal tournament for him in terms of the narrative around him and his position and where he's sort of seen as an England player, if it's a midfielder or a wing back. I have to admit, I was disappointed the other day not to see him start ahead of Kieran Trippier. I still found the balance a little bit wrong in the team, if I'm being completely honest, with Trippier on the left-hand side and Saka on the right. And then I'd have much preferred to have seen Saka on the left-hand side and Trippier on the right, and Trent on the right-hand side, because the quality that he possesses in a game and being able to change a game. I like Trippier as a player, but I don't think he gives you that quality that Trent has in that position. But listen, he can still have a big effect on the game. We've seen it from substitutes throughout the tournament already, where they come onto games and they have huge effects on them.
I was going to ask you about that Trippier position, because that seems to have been an area that's really faltered for England in the tournament down the left-hand side. We saw Luke Shaw come into this game, very late in a tournament, his first minutes, his first appearances. We know that none of us know how Luke Shaw is feeling in terms of that run out, but potentially it's an indication that Gareth wanted to give him minutes, and therefore would you expect that Luke Shaw comes into this team now to give that balance on the left? And maybe talk about it as a former left-sided player yourself, just what the difference is between being a right-footed player playing on the left and being a more thoroughbred left-footed player.
Yeah, I think the big thing is I'm very surprised it's taken this long for Luke Shaw to get up to speed. I don't think that probably the staff and Gareth would have thought that it would have taken this long. But I still think he's got it wrong in the fact of you should have taken another naturally left-sided player. I think when you're looking at the system now, the one player who stands out in the latter stages of the season was Tyreek Mitchell from Crystal Palace. He plays in that wing-back position in the 3-4-3, plays it extremely well. However, we go back to Luke Shaw. I think if he hasn't had any major reactions to the injury, I think you have to start him. He brings a natural balance to that position. Now, would he be able to last as long playing as a wing-back? Probably not, but I think if you can find the balance of going four at the back, and he gives you that balance. When you're asking the question about being a left back and what it does for you, now Kieran Trippier has a pro playing on that side, and the pro being that most wingers these days are, if you're playing on the right wing, you're left footed. If you're playing on the left wing, you're right footed. So you're naturally coming inside. So as a fullback, you're showing them onto your strongest foot, and that's a good thing to have. So me being a left back was always difficult playing against, if you're talking for Iron Robin or a Joe Cole, always wanted to come inside, and you're coming inside onto your weaker foot. You're always trying to push your left foot across them, which is always a difficult skill. It's easier to tackle with your right foot and you're just not as comfortable in that side. But then you go to defending. You're used to looking a certain way, your body position, the shape of your way you look, and you're looking at the ball and maybe midfield, and you've got your winger on the outside. Your body position naturally is always to see that winger on your left hand side. Well, when you change the position, you go onto the opposite side, it just becomes so alien to you and it becomes very uncomfortable. And that's such a different skill set. And then when you go onto the ball as well, the balance of being able to get that ball out of your feet and knock it down the line comfortably to change the position of attack. Going up against a winger who knows you're right-footed, he can always push you into position. He always knows you're going to go back. I'd probably say 90% of Kieran Trippier's passes throughout the tournament have gone backwards. And that's no fault of his own. It's just the way you would defend against him. It's natural to be able to push him back that way. However, if you were to put a... talk and take Ezra or Saka on when he plays on the other side, and he's a naturally gifted winger. Saka can take people on. It's different. Kieran Trippier doesn't take people on. He's not that type of player. He's a fullback, so he's not going to be able to beat people in 1v1 situations. So it's such a difficult skill to be able to do, and that's where, when we talk about balance, having a naturally left-sided player with a left foot just gives you that natural balance to be able to play down the line. And it also helps your winger as well, because when you've got your winger, you know you have to go inside, because he always wants to take his touch as a right back or as a right-footed player inside to be able to play a forward pass. And the only way of doing that essentially is for Foden to come off the line, and it clogs things up in that central area with Bellingham and Kane wanting to come in there as well.
So, and I know he's a right back, but doesn't this put into sharper focus than ever the absence of a player like Ben White, who is, in the conversation as one of the world's most informed defending players in the peak of his powers, that the management within the England setup haven't been able to break bread with him and have him there. He's sitting at home on the beach somewhere. His name's not even mentioned in the conversation for obvious reasons that he's not there. But if he was there, would the conversation around England's defensive setup be an entirely different one?
I'm not so sure, because if you want a back four, I still think Kyle Walker would be your right back. I think if you're going with a back three, I think still Kyle would be that player who plays on the right of the three with John Stones in the middle. I think what Ben White does do is he obviously gives you the ability to play in various positions. But I think what he's done is he's obviously had a breakdown of communication or a fallout with Ben White in some way. And he's probably looked at Joe Gomez and Kieran Trippier and thought, well, those players will cover enough positions. Gomez can play right across the back line. Kieran Trippier can obviously play either full-backs positions or wing-back positions. So I think he's looked at that and thought, well, that's enough for me to be able to cover that back line. Ezri Konsa can play, as we saw in the week, he can play left side of the three, he can play right side of the centre-backs or left side, and then he can play right back as well. So I think Ben White's just in that position at the moment where he's probably waiting for a new manager to come in. And these things happen in football. It's sad to see, because I think Ben White's been absolutely terrific this season and last season. I think he's been one of the most consistent players in the Premier League over the last few years, even at his time at Brighton. And even when he was at Leeds on loan, I thought he was outstanding, and he's just progressed and progressed. But there's obviously a little bit of something going on behind the scenes. So, it's just, I don't see him getting called up again under Gareth.
Okay. Well, if England lose before the final, then he might be called up sooner than we think. So we mentioned off the top that the Spain-France game will have been played by the time most of our listeners listen to this podcast. Hopefully for the sake of non-partisan football fans, Spain get through. The last thing we need is another boar fest from France. as much, look, I mean, I know obviously the World Cup final was one of the, if not best ever World Cup finals. So, you know, it's fair to say that that they could turn up and actually play under Didier Deschamps. But in this tournament, that's not what we've seen. Your prediction for that game and then the final, what are your thoughts on how this is going to play out?
Rob, can I just touch on, so you want England to get to the final and have a ball fest as well?
No, I think England I take your point, mate. It's well made. But we'll just play the last 5 minutes or might just go straight to the penalty shootout. But seriously, if Spain get to the final, that may well force the hand of whoever they're playing against.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's I mean, Spain have been pleasing on the eye, haven't they? But they've also been very well organised in the way that they play. They've got two very exciting wingers, but they've got a constant in that midfield area, which is Rodri, who just makes everything tick. He protects that back four. He protects the two midfielders when they go and press. He allows those wingers to go forward and play as high as they want because you know that you've got this absolute Rolls Royce of a midfielder who spots danger, senses it, but also when you're on the attack can pick those passes out as well. I mean, the guy is just a phenomenal player. And we often look at these two wingers in the team at the moment who are getting all the headlines, and we're taking away the focus of what's actually making everything work. And that is the key component. That is Rodri. But credit where it's due. Spain went down a little bit of unconventional route in the appointment of the manager, come through the youth systems, and obviously knew a lot of the players coming through, but went back to that style of what we're used to seeing with Spain, and that attack-minded football, but with organisation and how to press when they lose the ball and win the ball high up, and they smother teams. They're exciting on the eye, but I still see France causing them a lot of problems. I really do. I still think France are a very well-organised team who not many want to go up against. Mbappe, if he's on his day, which hasn't been this tournament, but he can turn it on in an instant. And they've also got other players that can hurt you. So it will be a fascinating game. Obviously, it'll be played out by the time this goes on. But I think the winners of the tournament will be out of that game. Mm. I still believe that.
Yeah, look, it feels like that. I wonder whether Mbappe might just rip that face mask off and go for broke, because that seems to be the thing that's holding him back, doesn't it? You know, the discomfort not only of having to wear that thing, but the lack of peripheral awareness and that fractional millimetre or two of the size of that face mask. Okay, so you're not saying who you think will win out of those two, but that'll be the tournament champion, and I guess it's a natural point to make after that this is the end of Gareth Southgate if they lose that final and don't lift the silverware on the final day of the tournament.
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, I think it would have been the end of Gareth Southgate's reign either way. Whether he wins the tournament, you go out on a high. If he loses it, I think it's that time to move on anyway and bring in the next step. I think Gareth's been, often when you're on a journey, you need someone to come in and do certain bits and pieces and put certain foundations in place. And I think Gareth's done that. But then to go to that next level, there's also got to be an understanding from the FA's point of view is that he's gone as far as he can. And now we need that extra bit of something. And whoever that might be, we're unsure of, but I do think that will be the next step. Listen, he might surprise us all, and the team might surprise us and play incredible football against the Dutch and then go win in the final, and we'll all be made to look a little bit silly. I don't see it playing out that way, but it might be completely different. But yeah, I mean, when you look back on his reign, I think what you have to say is with Gareth is that he's given England fans some incredible times. You look back to the summers that the fans have had of late, and you'd say it's been incredible to reach semi-finals and quarter-finals is quite brilliant, and the final of the Euros is magnificent. But people always want more. People always want that end goal, and they always want that victory. But it's very tough in football to be able to do that. But he's done an incredible job. I will have to say that. But again, it's this is the elite football. This is the best of the best. And I think if you're England with that squad, I'd want the best of the best manager as well.
Yeah, fair enough. Look, who knows? He might get a result. They might come out firing. Harry Kane might find some form, and they might get the result. But it doesn't feel like that right now, just a few days out from the final. Stephen, thanks again for coming on. And by the way, before we let you go, I'm sure there's plenty of our listeners who had a bit of a giggle at the social media snafu that thankfully, I think that was the word, wasn't it, mate?
You
nimbly dodged, but it was just a lot of fun. But doesn't it show you, mate, the days of social media? Like anything, any word, anything you do, it's sitting out there, and maybe it just shows how popular you are, mate, that all these people are listening to you and interested in what you have to say.
Yeah, we're all the human.
Exactly. That's why we're on a podcast, mate. We can edit it out. Stephen, thanks again, mate. Stay well. Enjoy the rest of the tournament, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
No, thanks for having me on, guys. Really appreciate it. Go well.
Stephen Warnock, one of the great men of international football, always generous with his time, and great to have a yarn to about the Euros. Okay, stick around. World Cup Corner next on Box to Box.
Willa, willa, willa. Everybody's going to buy Hoyts and Spices. Everyone's going to save a dollar or two. Everybody's going to buy Hoyts and Spices, yeah.
We talk about flavour pack meals on this show every single week. I'm just going for the simplicity again this week. Sometimes I know I get complicated, you know, use half a dozen different flavours in a meal, but does anyone like tuna in their pasta?
Very much so, Rob. Tonijn in Dutch.
Ah, nice. Derek, do you ever make a pasta with tuna in it?
I did. It was the staple of my student days where everything had to come in a tin.
Well, you know what? Tuna is one of the best proteins you can get from a tin to turn it into something fantastic. And you know all you need to make it an absolute star dish for your evening meal edge is Hoyt's dried chili. Bit of four-color peppercorn mix wouldn't go astray. Some of the Himalayan rock salt as well, but you crush some garlic.
It's funny you say that, Rob, because when Willem dropped into Bangkok on the way to Europe, he replenished my dried chili supply and replenished my four peppercorn mix supply, which I also put the dried chili and the four peppercorn mix into a Thai omelette.
Ooh, that is nice. Crush it in a mortar and pestle, and yeah, that's a good idea. Well, with this one, you get the olive oil, you get probably one or two cloves of crushed garlic, and then about a teaspoon of Hoyt's dried chili. An anchovy. Now, even if you hate anchovies, the flavour just bursts out when you fry it off, and you know that really fishy taste disappears. Then you put the tuna in, some the cracked pepper, the salt, and then you've got your pasta on the one side. Once the pasta's cooked in with the tuna, that dry chili just makes it zing. Anyone liking the sound of that? Yeah, nods don't work on radio. We've discussed that before, gentlemen. Lips chopping or smacking work, we can hear.
I didn't want to salivate with my mic on, Rob. No one wants to hear that, but it sounds damn good.
Now we will talk over each other because he didn't throw it at one of us, he throws to all of us.
Well, I'm just sort of looking for each of you with your wonderful podcast radio craft to just leap in and answer. So next time I will take it as a given that I need to know or nominate you by name before you can speak, Michael. You always require that before you jump in during the rest of the show. So why wouldn't you need it during the middle of one of our ads? Now remember to refill your Ambi spice jars with Hoyt's value packs. You'll be happy with Hoyt's at Coles, Woolworths and all good independent supermarkets.
Fill those empties with Hoyts and Spices, yeah.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyts Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. And what a top bloke Stephen Warnock is. If you're listening out there and you think, is he a good guy? Is he as good a bloke as he sounds? Then we guarantee that he is. We've covered the game on this show for 10 years now and reached out to, you know, just about everybody in football journalism, the pundits that are out there. And, you know, we get a range of responses, and the ones that you hear more often than not are obviously the enthusiastic ones that know that they've got a vocation, a legacy to leave behind. And you know, Stephen, always friendly, always polite and always generous with his time. So thank you again, Stephen. All right, well, we're going to bring it home. We're going to give a little teaser to some of our stoppage time topics, but you kick us off, Willem.
Yeah, well, the Matildas alumni have written back to Football Australia chair and to Isaac Robb in their response to what we've been speaking about for a couple of weeks now, Football Australia's decision to reinterpret the 1975 as the first Matildas. And there's some pretty strong language in here: harmed, puzzled, hurt, questioning the process of reviewing and reinterpreting the Matildas' history and the many implications of implementing it. Edge has gone into this in depth, and that is... it is literally a story for another day for us, because we're going to unpack it in good depth in stoppage time. So we'll hold that for now, as you want to jump back in.
Yeah. So Edge, I mean, just give us a little teaser for those of our listeners who they're aware of the blow up that's occurred with the change in recognition. But you look at this very legal letter, 6 pages long, with 60, a minimum 60 Matildas alumni from Julie Dolan, Cheryl Salisbury, Moya Dodd, a significant name in there as a former administrator, and a lot of players who weren't prepared to put their name to this letter. This is a significant fracture in Australian football, Edge.
Yeah, for those people that are sort of just catching up with it, effectively, for a long time, there's been a group of women who... were primarily from St George in 1975, went to the precursor to the AFC Asian Women's Cup. It was called the Asian Ladies Trophy or something like that. That team has always maintained that they were the first Matildas, and previous boards of Football Australia had assessed that claim and rejected it and had a process around that. The current new board, led by Anta Isaac, has effectively overturned that decision and announced that the 1975ers, what loosely termed as the 75ers, are now the first Matildas, relegating the names like Julie Dolan, who was the first Matildas captain, no longer holds that title. Also, you know, the first Indigenous player not holding that title anymore. Within the Matildas alumni, which you think is an extremely important stakeholder group, you know, effectively all of them, bar just a few, outraged by the decision, saying that it belittles the national cap, and it's a decision that's caused great hurt. So, Football Australia, by making this announcement and this decision by overturning previous boards, has opened a Pandora's box. And in stoppage time, Tracy Holmes did a fabulous job. She talked to all of the key people in the dispute, including the chairman of Football Australia, Anta Isaac, and I've just clipped up some of that useful topic to help unpack. And you can see, as a result of what's said by all people, that the fracture is absolutely enormous. And, you know, where there's so much goodwill around the Matildas brand, I guess people who don't have a vested interest in this particular issue are a bit perplexed why Football Australia has, with something that was dead and buried, opened up such a issue that's causing great hurt and distress amongst the Matildas alumni.
Another big bit of news that has slipped through over the past couple of weeks, but certainly needs to be touched on, is a seismic transfer at the very top of the women's game over in England. Vivian Miedema has left Arsenal for Manchester City. Now, if you're going to move to big clubs in the women's game, it's generally one that you might only meet in the Champions League. So this is, yeah, pretty significant. Derek, she still is the leading all-time goal scorer in the Women's Super League with 125 goals, but she's only made 8 appearances in the last 18 months or so after 2 knee reconstructions, and Arsenal didn't offer her a new deal. And she's still only 27, so that just shows how good she was pre-25.
Yeah, this is going to be one of my topics in stoppage time, but you're right. Her record for Arsenal is outstanding. You know, I like her not just because she's Dutch, but to Dennis Bergkamp, just in her style of play, you know, the impact that she's had on the team since she joined Arsenal from Bayern Munich. And look, we're not behind the scenes at Arsenal. We don't know what's going on in terms of pay, wage structure. We don't know who they're clearing the decks for. And yes, you're right, she hasn't been as prominent a feature in the team. They've obviously signed Alessia Russo, and Stina Blackstenius is obviously a, you know, key member of the forward line at Arsenal at the moment. But what I'll be contemplating in stoppage time is why Arsenal would allow such a prized asset to go for free. Obviously, they have no control over who they join, but yes, she's gone and joined one of the teams that Arsenal will be hoping to finish above next season. Arsenal had a poor season last season by their standards, and Just hemorrhaging your best players to the opposition doesn't feel like a good strategy. But more on that in stoppage time.
Yes, I'll be sitting on the bench and I'll look forward to it with interest. All right, boys, we've got a busy week of football. The big finishes of both the Euros and the Copa by this time next week, we'll know the winners. Derek, thanks again. Great to have you back, mate.
Thank you.
Willem, excellent work. You're in Amsterdam still enjoying the European summer.
Yeah, down in Eindhoven at the minute, Rob, with the family. My sister's over, so she's getting the tour and the Dutch. They're starting to believe. You never know. I reckon they're half a sniff against England. And, yeah, they're a little bit flat on the national team, but after that Turkey result, it has changed over here. It's palpable, you could say. So exciting week coming up.
And have you seen any first-hand examples of the Le Orange chant? What is that called? What's the official name of it?
Orania, na links, na rex, the left to the right.
Yeah, it's good. If you haven't seen any of it, just jump on social media. There's some great examples of like crowd behaviour, both in the stadiums and in the warm-ups. So all the rubbish we see sometimes going on in stadiums, that's a bit of fun, isn't it, Edge?
No, they do a fabulous job, especially, you know, I've been to many World Cups when you see thousands and thousands of Netherlands supporters doing the left to the right on the way to the stadium marching and with the orange smock. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it is good.
Thanks, and that double-decker bus that keeps going around, Willem, have you seen the double-decker bus?
I've seen the double-decker bus from about a metre and a half away, Edge, and they've also got the busts, which look really cool. They've got the, of Rijkaard, Cruyff, Van Basten, Arjen Robbins on there. They look awesome.
Excellent. I'm going to put one of Ronald Koeman in if they lift the trophy in about a week's time. And to our good mate, Adam Maloney, who clips all these great sound bites up for us and edits the show and pulls it all together. Thanks again to you, mate, and to our listeners. Thanks again. Please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Make sure you subscribe to Box to Box, Stoppage Time and Offside. Tweet us at Box to Box NTS and follow us on X. Make sure you like us on Facebook too. And join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.